Today's guest is a supporting sponsor of Liberty and Finance.
Welcome back to Liberty and Finance. We're delighted to have this returning guest. Tony Giardini is the CEO of Trilogy Metals. We found out about Trilogy Metals through our mutual friend Rick Rule in his Natural Resource Symposium. Tony joins us again for an update on some progress that is decidedly positive for the company. Tony, thanks for coming back on Liberty and Finance.
Dungan, thanks for having us back. We enjoy our opportunity to catch up and talk about the markets and talk about Trilogy and give your listeners an update on what's going on with the company.
Before we get to the company, we'd like to get an update from you since you are an industry insider into the macro picture of supply and demand that's driving a lot of interest in the futures of the metals industry. You have a slide that I'd like to bring up right now called Why Copper, talking about being critical to the transition to green energy and clean energy. This has been a big story for the last couple of years, and it looks like it's not going away anytime soon. And we've talked with a variety of insiders in the mining industry who've talked about this dearth of development and exploration over the past couple of decades that are going to quite likely result in some shortages of critical metals going forward, but we'd like to get your take on that. You have a slide here that talks about demand versus before and after the green energy transition and versus supply. If you could kind of walk us through what's the big picture? What do people really need to understand about the availability of such critical materials as copper going forward?
I think it's really the key to a lot of the copper stories is really what's going to happen on the supply side. And, I think, as you mentioned, there's considerable focus on copper as we transition to clean energy. You may be aware that in the past couple of weeks, a bipartisan group of lawmakers in the U.S. have sent a letter to Deborah Haaland arguing that copper should be declared a critical metal in the U.S. And the thought, of course, being that the U.S. needs to focus on domestic copper supply to ensure that it has copper available as, you know, the transition continues to build momentum. So, you know, this idea of the demand side is definitely there. We're seeing it in terms of not just EV, but you're going to see it in terms of infrastructure that needs to be built as we transition to clean energy. And, you know, my sense is that demand is, as that slide indicates, demand is definitely on the increase. The big challenge that we have is really on the supply side. And, I've been in this this business for a long time, and I've been involved with the development of some very large copper developments, including Oyu Tolgoi and Kamoa-Kakula, Oyu Tolgoi in Mongolia, Kamoa-Kakula in the DRC. And Kamoa-Kakula might be the exception where once the building started, even in the pandemic, was able to get done, you know, on schedule and on budget. But I think that is the exception. And what we're seeing across the board is that very difficult to build these projects. It's very difficult to find these new deposits. And right now, when you look at the top 10 global copper mines that are operating, their mine life, they've been operating for roughly 95 years. And those are a lot of those mines. I know those are a lot of the mines that are in Chile have been around for decades and decades and decades. And so now what we're seeing is the mines are getting deeper. And we're not talking about underground mines. We're talking about big open pits. Mines are getting deeper. They're mining lower and lower grades, which means that they have to move more and more material to get the same tonnage produced. The costs are increasing as a result, and the costs are increasing because of input costs, because of inflationary considerations, and just, you know, the fact that they're mining more material and lower grades. And then there's the whole ESG and political issues associated with these large operations. And water is going to be a big critical issue in a lot of these jurisdictions, including Chile and Peru. And, you know, there's a big battle in Chile where the focus on water resources is, should it go towards agriculture? Should it go towards mining? They're looking at building these big desal plants to really continue to have sufficient water to move these projects forward. So there's going to be a lot of challenges. And then we're seeing the taxation and royalty situation play out, whether it's in Panama, Chile, or Peru. So I think there's a lot of factors at play that are going to really cause people to be very cautious about bringing new mines into production. And so I think what has to happen is prices have to increase to incentivize this new development to occur. And then you've got your different issues in the U.S. where, you know, we've seen a number of instances where projects that have been advanced look like they're not going to be going forward, whether that's a Twin Metals project in Minnesota, or Resolution seems to be having some challenges in Arizona and others. So, you know, there's lots of issues that are impacting the supply side. So when we look at the fundamentals, I think, you know, there's lots of opportunity for copper prices to move significantly higher from where they are right now.
If we could stay for one moment on the topic of green energy / clean energy, there's been a lot of debate and frankly some sharp criticism by skeptics of the rapidity with which we can move forward in that movement, saying, you know, just by legislative fiat, the government can say, oh, we've got to have so many EVs by 2030, et cetera. But if you don't have the infrastructure in place to be able to charge those and the grids are already having trouble, et cetera, but doesn't that potential upgrades necessary to the grid also require those same metals, such as copper?
They do. And, you know, copper is going to be needed not just on the grid side. If you're going to be looking at you're going to be looking at wind power, those wind turbines use lots of copper as well. And so there's lots of, you know, copper is going to play not just in the EVs themselves, which use considerably more copper than an ICE vehicle, but it's going to be played into the grid and the distribution that needs to be in place, the charging infrastructure that needs to be built out, and, you know, wind turbines specifically. So there's lots of factors, and you could see substitution occur at some point, but at this point, copper seems to be pretty resilient in terms of what it's being used for. And I think that supply and the number of new mines that will need to come into production to meet the growing demand, or it's just going to be very challenging to see that happen.
Now, there's new news out from Trilogy, and that's specifically this next generation of your feasibility study results that you've had out. The last time we spoke with you, we were awaiting the result of that feasibility study. Can you talk to us about what the scope of that is, what it entails, and what the new awarenesses are that come through that?
Sure. So the reason we prepared an updated feasibility study was really for our U.S. reporting purposes. We had originally prepared at the Trilogy level a feasibility study in 2020, in August 2020, and we had passed that on along to the JV, which is called Ambler Metals, which is a 50-50 JV with South32. So Ambler, over the last 2.5 years, has completed engineering trade-off studies in 2021 and engineering design changes with updated costs in 2022. And since Trilogy is a domestic issuer in the U.S., we have to comply with U.S. regulatory requirements. And the specific requirement is called SK-1300, which is a regulation that comes into play for 2022 fiscal year end. So what we've done is we've taken the Ambler Metals work that they've done in terms of revised engineering design, updated all the costs to be current with our fiscal year end 2022. And, you know, what we've seen, of course, is this inflationary environment. The costs have increased both on the operating side, but also on the capital side. And that's partly due to inflation, partly due to supply chain. And then we've also updated our commodity prices to long-term consensus. So when we look at the overall study results, and we talked about a slide that is in the deck that I think your listeners can look at, and that's slide 20, which you'll put up in the presentation. What that shows is a financial results from our 2020 feasibility study, our 2023 feasibility study, and what we look at like at spot. So basically, just to summarize, we had a $1.55 billion pre-tax NPV at 8% under the 2020 feasibility study. It's now $1.5 billion under the 23 feasibility study, using a higher spot price and using contemporary capital and operating costs, with an increased contingency from what we had previously. And then when we look at it at spot prices, then this was with copper at $4.02. The pre-tax NPV is roughly $2.15 billion. And if we look at IRRs, just comparing them on a pre-tax basis from 2020 to 2023 and its spot, 2020 was 27%, 2023 is 23%, and at spot is roughly 28%. So we're pretty happy with the results. We think there's a lot more work to be done to bring the costs down, and we think that we sort of caught the high water mark in terms of inflationary impacts on capital and operating costs. And, you know, as I said at the outset, Dunnigan, when we prepared this study, it was really for regulatory purposes. So we haven't really rolled up our sleeves and pushed back on some of the cost estimates that are included in the study. And we think there's opportunity to bring those costs down. Fuel costs were a big change. And then we've also included a number of changes in terms of the environmental improvements focused on water treatments. So we've had significant design changes that optimize water treatment. We've put a liner over the waste rock containment facility, which will reduce water infiltration after closure, and it minimizes water collection and treatment. And we've added a tailings thickener and water process pond, which will use less energy and result in less fuel consumption. So a lot of positive changes with respect to the study, but we think there's still a lot more opportunity for improvement, and they'll continue to really look at how it can be improved going forward. We've also updated the mineral resources, and the resource pretty much held up from what we had. In fact, the mine life has increased by 1 year from what we had previously. The average grade of the deposit at Arctic continues to be very high on both the resource and on an inferred basis, and compares very favorably to other projects out there. And there's a slide that's available on our website, trilogymetals.com, in this presentation that really compares us to a number of other projects out there. And I would really encourage people to have a look at the grade profile. Then we also have another slide in that presentation that talks about how Arctic compares on a profitability index, which looks at after-tax IRR and after-tax NPV, and it's right up at sort of the top right of the chart, which is where you want to be. So I think overall, we're pretty happy with the results of the feasibility study, Dunnigan.
One thing that a lot of people are facing in their everyday lives, and they realize that companies that are trying to get things done in today's world are facing the same pressures, is, and you mentioned it, increased costs from due to inflationary pressures. And at the same time, there have been gyrations in spot prices in the marketplace for metals. So I noticed in slide 21, it caught my eye. It's called Arctic Evolution of Basket Price. And it contrasts the costs of operating the mine, the cash cost of operating mine versus some of the potential value there. Can you help people understand why that one tells a story that may be promising for Trilogy going forward?
Yeah, I think one of the really things that really differentiates our Arctic project from many other projects out there is that it's a polymetallic project. So it's a copper, zinc, lead, gold, silver deposit. So when we talk about the basket, what we're looking at is what is the value of a ton of ore at a spot prices. So the slide that you're referencing, I'd like to say that it's original, but I have to say I took it from my time at Ivanhoe when they were looking at the Platte Reef deposit and comparing it to other precious metals deposits. And what this shows is that right now, based on the basket of prices, we're looking at about $320 per ton of probable reserves, which isn't at the highs, but it's not far from the highs. And it compares very favorably with the average mine cost, which is about $70 a ton. So there's lots of room for profit in those numbers. And where we really benefit from is in having this diversified metal production, which helps really offset some of those big increases. The other item, or the other statistic that is included in that financial results at spot slide, is something called capital intensity ratio. And what that is it takes the capital associated with the project and it divides it by a copper equivalent ton. And although the feasibility study in 2020 showed that to be about 7,300. It's gone up to 10,600 in the 2023 feasibility study. That still compares very favorably on the low end against any of the projects out there. And that really speaks once again to this basket of metals that we're producing and have the opportunity to produce at Arctic, which really differentiates the projects from others.
Now, everything we've been talking about so far is either economic or metals demand, that sort of thing, but there are completely different factors that come into play that affect how effective it will be to get permitting done, get operating, and stay operating in a different jurisdiction. You've had some progress on that front, I understand, which I didn't know about. We spoke in the past about a lawsuit that was ongoing that was causing an unexpected delay in some of the permitting and progress. It sounds like there's been some unexpected progress there.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's unexpected. I mean, there's been a lot of work done behind the scenes to really have people reconsider their positions. And just, you know, for your listeners, I'll give a bit of background. This project has been around a long time. And the key to development of this project has always been about a road that needs to be built into this district. And in 2015, the state of Alaska started the process of permitting that road. And it was a five-year process, and it resulted in a record of decision, which was effectively the JROD was issued the summer of 2020, which allowed for the development of a road. And so we were in a great position, and we anticipated as soon as that that permit was granted that there was going to be litigation. And initially, the litigation came from NGOs, initially in the lower 48, and then from some NGOs in Alaska. And subsequently, they were joined by some tribal villages in the interior of the state, which were located a significant distance from the road, but they were willing to sign on to the litigation. There were five villages in total, which none of those villages are overly large. I think the largest is probably a couple hundred, maybe 300 people in total. But nonetheless, they represented people that live in those communities that had concerns about the project, particularly about the private industrial nature of the project or the road, that they wanted to see that it was going to be a private industrial use road only. And they were concerned about subsistence and cultural heritage issues. So when those tribes joined in the litigation, I think it came to the forefront in terms of the opposition. And when the new Biden administration came in, they took over effectively acting as a defendant for the lawsuit and wanted to revisit the relationship with these tribes to understand if there was a path to get to resolution without having the lawsuit. So they had actually approached the tribes and had paused the lawsuit for about a month in November of 2021. And there was nothing that ended up happening as a result of that. And then in February of 22, the BLM, Department of Interior, made the decision to remand the ROD, which meant that they were going to pause the ROD while they fixed, in their views, certain deficiencies that needed to be addressed as part of the work that had previously been done over that five-year time period. So we're in the process of seeing a draft EIS to deal with those specific issues on sustainability or on sustainability and cultural heritage. And the final EIS is expected to be out towards the latter part of this year. So these tribes were part of that lawsuit. And what's happened is two of those tribal councils voted unanimously. And there was a press release out, in fact, last night, which if anyone's interested, we could certainly provide a copy, but there's stories in the Alaskan press and basically indicating that those two tribal organizations have withdrawn from the lawsuit. And what's interesting is really the comments of the tribal leadership, where they're really highlighting that they see that there's opportunities for economic growth and stability in their region through higher education and jobs that could result from the development of a road, and ultimately the development of a mine. And there's also this recognition of the need for these critical metals that and the domestic need of supplies for, of those critical metals. So it's great news, not wholly unexpected, because I think there've been a pretty good dialogue going back and forth through different committees that have been established. And so we're very excited about the developments. And I think the next step will be to see if the other three villages that are still part of a lawsuit also are willing to reconsider their participation in the lawsuit. So I would say it's a great outcome, but there's still a lot of work to do in terms of ensuring that there continues to be a lot of dialogue with the Native communities and the tribal leaders in those communities to help them understand the potential impact of the Ambler Access Project in terms of jobs, job training, benefits to their communities in terms of being able to bring materials and supplies into their communities that would hopefully bring their costs of living down. So great news, we hope for more information in terms of next steps on what happens with these tribal villages and hopefully their support for the project going forward.
Yeah, and it sounds like in some cases, training and educational resources or medical facilities, that sort of thing. So it's always interesting to see the reality play out, which is always more complex than sort of the black and white story we hear on the evening news, for those of you who still watch that. But to understand that there is a mutual, there's a win-win that can be found and should be sought. And it's encouraging to see productive progress along that pathway towards that. For people who've been watching Trilogy for some time or stakeholders, I'm sure that that comes as welcome news.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned inflation and how people are sort of struggling with inflation. And there's an article in the Anchorage Daily News that talks about this, you know, these two villages pulling out, and the chief from one of the villages comments that, you know, gasoline in their community is $11.50 a gallon, right? 100-pound propane tank is $305 a gallon. A 12-pack of soft drinks are roughly $20. So this is the challenges that these communities are facing, right? And they need to. People living there need to figure out how they're going to be employed, how they're going to be able to bring their cost of living down in these communities. And so I think the rethinking of participating in the lawsuit, certainly part of it is the economics of job creation, job training, and hopefully bringing down their cost of living in these very remote communities.
Well, we're glad for this update. We've been following Trilogy together with your help for some time and would like to continue to stay appraised of this, because it sounds like, as Rick Rule alerted us in the beginning, he sees value and he wants us to pay close attention where he sees value. And that's what we're trying to do here for the benefit of all of our viewers, all of our subscribers. We're grateful for your update here and look for more in the future. We've been speaking with Tony Giardini. He's the CEO of Trilogy Metals. Tony, any final thoughts for our viewers before we wrap?
No, look, once again, I just want to thank you, Liberty and Finance, and Dunnigan yourself for, you know, having us back on. We enjoy our opportunities to really give people more insight into what's going on. And I'm glad the timing worked out that we had some, you know, good news to be able to share with respect to what's happening on the road. We've had the recent news on the FS. I encourage people to visit our website, trilogymetals.com. We trade on the New York and Toronto Stock Exchange under the ticker symbol TMQ. Thanks again for your time, and look forward to any questions from anyone listening to the presentation. Please feel free to reach out to me through Trilogy directly. Thank you.
Yeah, and you folks, you'll find the ticker symbol and the link to the presentation that we looked at today in the description of this video, as well as general information on how to get a hold of Trilogy. Tony, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks again, Donegan. Really appreciate it.